Special announcement time again! It's another week on, and another week closer to our first live show at the Vault Festival on the 29th of February at 4:30 p.m. And last week we announced our first guest on the show, Beck Hill, and we have another guest to reveal. We're taking the dust cloth off it now, and there she stands. It's Dr. Anna Porshaisky. Oh, yes.
Yeah, you might remember Anna guested on our show, I'm going to say a year, 18 months ago, to talk about the world's worst material. Mm. And after a few jokes about my job, we talked. Did we go with graphene in the end?
I think we've talked about pycrete, we talked about graphene, we talked about Vanta Black, the darkest substance known to man.
That's what it was.
All sorts of things. Yeah.
She is an incredible Renaissance woman. She is an award-winning scientist. She performs stand-up. She swum the channel, ladies and gentlemen. And we're really delighted to welcome her back on the show. So if you've listened to this and you really enjoyed Anna's episode, if you're a mate of hers, if you're a friend of hers, or if material science is really your bag, head to the Vault Festival website, vaultfestival.com, pop in Worst Foot Forward Live, and buy some tickets for you, your mates, and everyone you've ever met.
Other than that, the usual stuff. You can find more information about the show and indeed us on our Twitter account, at Worst Foot, or on Facebook, if you just search Worst Foot Forward, or on our website, worstfootforwardpodcast.com. That's enough for us.
I think so. Coming up next week is our 150th episode.
Oh, God.
Where me and Barry try not to lose our minds about the fact that we've been doing this for too long. Until then, everyone hop aboard the, I was going to say the SS Worst Foot Forward. What do you call trains? So they get a...
The TT.
TT, no.
Presumably SS is ship, and TT is train.
Sure, okay. Get aboard the TT Worst Foot Forward to find out about the world's worst train.
Hello and welcome to Worst Foot Forward, where we celebrate the best of the worst. I'm Barry McStay, and each week I, my co-host and our guest, propose our candidates for the title of the world's worst something. All aboard! Yes, we are leaving on that midnight train to Georgia. Although Ben and I slightly misunderstood the song, but nevertheless, we're both excited to sample the delights of Tbilisi. I'm hoping to experience all of that country's 49 types of soil. Thank you, Google. And Ben is determined to get the autograph of former Derby County footballer Georgie Kinkladze.
I'm far more interested in getting the autograph of former Newcastle United player Tamuri Ketchbayar. On you go.
We are welcomed onto the locomotive by a controller who is on a diet after years of fat shaming. We walk past first class and third class all the way to upper sixth. While on board the train, we are treated to all the usual train-based amenities. Strangers. A murder investigation led by a mustachioed Belgian snob. And a singing and dancing railway cat called Skimbleshanks with oddly human hands. And beside me is the creature of my very own CGI nightmares, Ben Vandeveld. Oh my God, he's got human hands too! I can see his wedding ring! It's like Judi Dench!
That's the only time in my life I will be referred and compared to Judi Dench. Sorry, referred to Judi Dench is the wrong thing.
I refer you to Judi Dench.
If your doctor
this case is too hard for me. I need to refer you to the Dench. Have you seen the Cats movie?
No, I watched the trailer and that was more than enough.
Do you know what I've decided about it is? It's actually, the problem with it now is everyone has slated so hard that when I eventually saw it, it's not as bad as everyone's making it out to be, but it's still really bad.
It's what's incredible. The more I read about it and look at it, the more I think that it is Hollywood's first attempt at a shit-posting feature film. Sometimes I will see a very talented actor in a film and be like, this has got contractual obligations written all over it. Not as much as contractual obligations to the footnotes. I abhor everything Andrew Lloyd Webber has done anyway. A man who, in the words of friend Jess Fostergue, has a face like a melted pig. it's more the judgment of people in it. Like, I don't know, maybe Dench and Ian McKellen are like, fuck it, we're going to be dead in 10 years anyway. Let's say yes to any old shit.
I think they're having a gas old time of it. What Idris Elba's doing, though, no idea. And when Rebel Wilson rips her own skin off to reveal a second skin but with a sparkly waistcoat underneath it.
Oh, no!
While munching CGI cockroaches.
That's
spoiler alert, anyway.
No, I don't need to watch it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, now we have absolutely ruined a movie for our guest. We should probably introduce her. She trained as a dancer and a performer, going on to study an MA at the Globe Theatre in King's College, London, specialising in British theatre of the 16th and 17th centuries, and also the dance therein, one can only presume. She then decided to cash in most of her performing chips and move on to work in museums and heritage venues, bringing together stories from the past and investigating their impact and relevance to people in the present. But we got her on this podcast for nothing to do with either dance or theatre, but maybe museums. Because for the past few years, alongside her peripatetic husband, Jeff, she has been on a YouTube mission to document and explore London and the UK at large, explicitly by rail. And we will ask her in a minute how much money that's cost her. She says that her curiosity in railways lay with the stories of social change and how public transport has altered our sense of space and surroundings. Now, that's all well and good, but the spreadsheet nerd in me is more delighted that since 2017 she's visited every fucking station in the United Kingdom on their mission.
And Ireland.
I'm getting to Ireland. She did that later.
Okay, fine.
But yeah, she's done all 198 stations in Ireland as well, and your diddy little Hornby system.
our train travel's much cheaper.
Of course,
that is true.
Yeah,
I mean,
and much more reliable.
I mean, I could talk at length on this.
Yeah, I don't worry, you will.
Please do. Let me get to the end of your introduction, and then I need to remind you of something that I've got to do.
You are a guest in this country. Why don't you go back the way I came from?
Of course.
Yeah, our trains will get you so far. Yeah. You can swim the rest of the way.
No, our Prime Minister's going to build you a bridge. Her first book, The Railway Adventures, was co-authored in 2018 and is now an Amazon bestseller. We're delighted to welcome someone who is thankfully on time, in the correctly reserved seat, and not owned by Richard Branson. It is the marvellous Vicky Pipe.
Hello.
Hello.
That all sounded quite impressive, actually. I've forgotten I'd, like, done all that.
Does owned by Richard Branson, is that a euphemism for being a virgin?
Yeah. Oh, I'm going to use that in future.
Oh, yeah.
Hello, Vicky.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
You're extremely welcome on here. I sort of feel very much like a Luke Skywalker in the presence of both Obi-Wan and Yoda.
Oh.
Because 3 years ago, or possibly 4 years ago, I walked the entire London Underground Network for charity.
Nice.
I had a lovely old time and got a lot of blisters, but it turns out I'm an absolute amateur compared to you and Jeff.
Let's qualify that by saying that was above ground, not along the tracks.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't a very long and ill-fated suicide attempt.
Yeah.
But that must have taken you a very long time. I want to know how you planned this. Like, did you line by line, or did section by section?
I had to do it section by section. So I initially wanted to do one line at a time.
Yeah.
But because I was trying to get it around my schedule of gigging during the day, I'd be on the Central, and then I'd go and do a DLR, and then I'd go and do a Piccadilly. But yeah, there were two rules that I discovered, because my wife and one of my best mates were the adjudicators. One, turns out if you visit Heathrow stations 1, 2, 3 and 5 but forget 4, you have to go all the way back to Austerlitz and then walk to number 4
absolutely.
Again.
Yeah, yes. I think that's fair.
I'm fully on board with that decision. Yeah.
And
you have to do the full loop at the end of the Central line.
I did the loop. Yeah, I absolutely did the loop. And that also, you can't, even if you walk past a station on another line, you can't just nip in and get it. You've got to stay on the line.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I adhered to those rules.
Okay.
So it took me about 6.5 weeks.
Okay.
And summit like 350 miles.
That's really impressive. Yeah. I thought it would have taken longer.
Really?
Yeah, especially if you're like doing it around other stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's, I'd sort of, so it worked out, because I think I did 5 or 6 days a week. And it
nice.
So it
added, I did a nice gentle bit with you.
You did. Where did you?
I think I did West Hampstead down to Baker Street or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, that was lovely. Yeah, there was some people who were there with me for the hellish hard yards.
Yeah,
the lovely bit was going up the Met Line to Amersham and Chesham.
Yeah.
Delightful. The worst bit was going up the District and the Hammersmith and City up to through Barking.
Yeah.
and then in Upminster, yeah. I thought I found a shortcut through a field. And I got lost,
oh, no.
And there were horses, and I had a bit of a breakdown.
Oh no!
But you've been to every station in the United Kingdom.
I have, yeah.
It's incredible.
2,563, but there are more now. More stations have opened, so we now have to go and visit. Obviously,
yeah.
We have to go back and visit them.
And are these ones that were old ones that they've reopened, or
good question. Yeah. So there is one in Scotland that's just opened, Rob Royston, which is just in the suburbs of Glasgow, and that used to be a station.
Yeah.
And I think it closed in like the 50s or something. They're literally reopening it in the same location.
Yeah.
But then there's one Warrington West and Worcestershire Parkway, which is they're just like brand new stations that they haven't been there before.
Well, what's the oddest station then you've been to?
Well, not oddest, but it's like right in the middle of nowhere, and it's actually mine and Jeff, my husband's favourite, one of our favourite stations, Carrawa in Scotland. It's right in the middle of Rannoch Moor, mm-hmm. and it was built there because the landowner at the time was like, yeah, you can build a railway through, but I want my own station. So they popped a station in.
Absolute legend.
And now you can't get to the station only by train because it's private estate, so the nearest public road is about 17 miles away. Like, it's so remote, but the station now, they've turned it into like a restaurant, and the signal box is an Airbnb, and you can like sleep, you can literally sleep right next to the train track, so you can wait when you wake up. We stayed there, we're lucky enough to have stayed there, and you sort of pull the blinds up, but then this huge like sleeper train is literally outside your window, like, right, you can like see, it's as close as I am to you right now around
and
this
you
table.
Open the blinds and Poirot is there going bonjour.
Exactly. Where were you at? Yeah. Well, I can't have gone anywhere, so I'm here.
And you used to work at the Transport Museum in London as well.
Yes, I did.
Which is very cool.
Many
if anyone who's not been, I recommend.
Yeah.
They are, no, Transport Museums, we were talking about my son before he came on the podcast. He's at the age where we can start taking him to galleries and museums.
Nice.
And every museum or gallery I've taken him to, the general reaction has been kind of like, yeah, I suppose it's all right. Oh, look, there's a dog. Right, I'm done, food. Apart from the Transport Museum in Glasgow, where he lost his shit at everything. And I can't wait to take him to the London one.
Brilliant.
There's something about transporting kids.
There really is. I think it's probably, that it's quite familiar to young people as well, particularly if you live in a city. Mm. You will see buses and you will see trains or you'll hear them.
Yeah.
And I think there's... Yeah, a lot of recognition from little ones.
I think when you're that age as well, they're sort of magical.
Yeah.
It is, every time you go out, you're on like a mechanical safari.
Uh-huh. Even when you're older, they're magical.
Oh, we all want to sit at the front on the top deck.
Exactly, or on the DLR. You
at the
want
front
to be
of the DLR.
Love the DLR.
A lot of people who are not from London will get that. Everyone in London will be like, absolutely,
yep.
100% agree.
I get really annoyed if I ever get on the DLR and there's a kid in that seat. I'm like, come on.
Obviously, one of the ones where the driver has a seat so you can't sit there.
Yeah.
Well, it should be like, obviously there should be, the little signs that say if you're pregnant or disabled or elderly, then the seats should be given up to you. Those seats at the front of the DLR should be a little sign that's got like a Dungeons and Dragons sign.
Yeah.
And it's like, if you're a nerd, you should be allowed to sit there.
Vicky, we always ask our guests what they're worst at in the world.
Yes.
What are you worst at?
I am worst at looking after plants. So any kind of gardening. Recently, my neighbours went away for Christmas and they said, would you water our plants? And I obviously said yes, but it filled me with so much fear because I kill every plant that I've ever had. Cactuses, dead. They're all...
Oh, yeah. Wow.
I don't know what I do. I don't know if I give them too much love.
Are you hugging your plants?
I heard it, it helps them grow.
Let the record show that Vicky is covered in spines. So So this week we're doing another Patreon episode. Our long good train noise, Vicky. Our long-term listener and supporter, Andy Elms. Hello, Andy.
Hi, Andy.
Has been donating $5 a month for a hell of a long time, and we finally got round to doing an episode for him all about the world's worst train. So, to begin with, we're going to go to Germany, mostly because I ruddy love the name of this one. It's the Propeller Triebwagen Schienen Zeppelin.
Oh, great name.
Yeah. Shortened to the Schienen Zeppelin. And this is the baby of a German engineer called Franz Kruckenberg. And in the late 1920s, he was a Zeppelin designer by training, but, you know, was obviously aware that train technology was getting updated. He'd had a go at creating a hanging monorail, but that didn't really work. So he tried something new, and he decided, streamlined, grey, aluminium, modern, bullet train, brilliant, powered by a giant propeller.
Yes. Yes. Catch the pigeon.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. How fast do you reckon this could go?
Oh, not at all. It didn't work.
Modest 50 miles an hour.
140 miles an hour. Yeah, it was set a speed record that would stand for another 23 years. however, you might be asking, why aren't all trains Schienen Zeppelins now? Well, it never got past the prototype stage for the very obvious reason that if that pulls into a station with its propeller whanging round outside, it might start picking commuters off the platform willy-nilly and turning them into shish kebabs. Yeah, there was also doubt as to whether the railroad tracks of the day could cope with the stress of his train. So it was destroyed during World War II, and then it was the train was stripped of its aluminium and turned into airplanes for the Luftwaffe. So it has a bit of a dark edge at the end of it.
Yeah.
Next, I went way back to sort of like the golden age of steam, I guess, like the 1850s, 1860s. Yep. Have you heard of a train called Fowler's Ghost?
I have not.
It's a great name, isn't it? So, looking at it, it looks sort of what... if I asked you to imagine a classic Thomas the Tank Engine steam train, it would look like that.
With a smiley face on the front.
There was no smiley face on the front. It's just blank.
Was it sentient, though?
There is. I showed my wife this picture the other day. You know the brilliant online artist Jim'll Paint It?
Oh, yes. Where you can tweet him just like, I want you to... paint a picture of Ben van der Velde as a pigeon in the House of Parliament or whatever, and he'll do
it. Precisely. I showed my wife this picture the other day, and it was a real, why would you do that, monster, stay away from our child. But someone asked him to paint him, someone asked him to make a Thomas the Tank Engine made of flesh with a face that reflects the agony of being twisted into the shape of a train.
Oh no!
Are you ready for this?
Okay.
Yeah.
One, two, three.
Oh my god! I'm slightly more disturbed by the fat control. Yeah,
can we retweet that from the show account, please?
Yeah.
That is horrifying.
The fat controller in full Victor Frankenstein. Yeah. They told me I couldn't make it possible. Yeah. The fools. So anyway, Fowler's Ghost. looks a lot like that. it was... built by, or designed by a chap called John Fowler, who built it for use on the Metropolitan Railway, which was the first line on the London Underground.
Indeed.
And because it would have to go through tunnels, they wanted to try and reduce the amount of steam that went out of it, you know, for visibility. So it was an experimental fireless 240 steam locomotive. Don't know what the numbers stand for. I presume it was the formation that the people loading the fire bricks into the engine were in. In conventional coal-fired locomotives, normally what would happen is that when there was so much fire that it was a little hot and a little dangerous inside the locomotive, a trapdoor would open in the floor and drop the fire onto the track.
Right.
I know that's... I know,
beneath these wooden trains.
I know this sounds insane.
Yeah.
But it was also to...
I think that's just sort of sunk in what you said.
No, no, you're right, because the early fire brigades, when houses were burning down, they'd just open a sinkhole underneath them.
Yeah,
I think that's their usual treatment.
But the problem with this is because it
the
was...
The problem with this.
Yes, do go on.
Because of the kind of fire bricks it used and the system it had, there was a real danger with this. That the boiler could overheat and explode as well. So this provision wasn't made for this. So
they didn't have the trapdoor.
They didn't
have
the trapdoor to make.
I'm so glad.
Yeah. So it was described by a contemporary writer as a very fine and sturdy creation. But the trouble was that her boiler would not only refrain from producing smoke, it produced very little steam either. So it was both highly explosive and didn't go very fast either. and so it was eventually mothballed a couple of years later. And it was called Fowler's Ghost because it was so rarely seen.
I see. They didn't make many of them. Did they?
Yes.
Did they make it to the tracks at all?
I don't think it made it to the tracks whatsoever.
Yeah.
I've got a couple more things to tell you about before my final suggestion. I did see if there was anything interesting on rail replacement bus services. The only interesting thing that I could find is that it's got the nickname of Bustitution. Which I like to think of that it's a bus that has fallen on hard times. Wander around the streets going, who fancies a ride? Ring my bell. But it's just bus and substitution portmanteau together. I did also look at, though, a gyro monorail. Have you seen pictures of this?
No.
So this was developed in the early 20th century.
It sounds like it was.
Yeah. And it was developed by a chap called Louis Brennan in the United Kingdom. He found it difficult to get... Have you just looked at a picture of it?
I've just looked at a picture of it.
Oh.
So it is a single rail, like, just imagine like a railway track, but one rail. And it is using an internal gyroscope to maintain balance.
It's like someone's gone, the train is basically roller skates, what we need is a roller blade.
Yep.
But that's what early 20th century... technology, and presumably not able to go very fast as well, which I imagine would help maintain balance if it was.
It reached speeds of 22 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So it was. There was a lot of enthusiasm for it under the Conservative government, and it was
bring it back after Brexit.
Yeah.
bang a bung for a gyro monorail for Brexit.
and bizarrely, the War Department were very enthusiastic for it. I don't know why. But
that's so odd. Why?
This will beat the Germans.
Yeah.
Trench warfare is only a cover for our monorail.
The Liberal government that got in 1906 were trying to be a little bit more spendthrifty and clearly took one look at this and went, absolutely not.
Yeah, good.
And stopped the funding, which, like I said, was coming from the army. However, the India Office... this dates it, voted for an answer of $6,000 in 1907 to develop the monorail for the northwest frontier. And a further $5,000 was advanced by the Durbar of Kashmir in 1908. Because, I don't know, maybe that's why the people of Kashmir are so angrily divided.
Yeah.
Like, the people on one side are like, we want a monorail! And the others are going, no, we want a proper railway, please.
I hear those things are awfully loud.
Yeah. it was eventually debuted in London in 1910 at White City as part of the Japan-British Exhibition.
Cool.
Yeah.
It carried 50 passengers at a time around a circular track at 20 miles an hour. Passengers included Winston Churchill.
Oh, cool.
And there was such interest in it at the time that children's clock monorail toys were sold, and they were even produced both in England and Germany. Possibly that might have been the cause of the war.
The monorail race.
Yes. But ultimately, it couldn't attract further investment, and in total, only two vehicles were ever built.
Oh.
One of them was sold as scrap, and the other was used as a park shelter until the year 1930.
So again, when it presumably collapsed.
One would imagine, just eventually the gyroscope ran out and it fell over. But for my suggestion, we're going to talk about the Holman train, which is an absolutely baffling creation. It is a train, but has many pointless bits to it. So again, imagine the old locomotive from late Victorian times, and you've got the chassis, big wheels with the, I don't know what it's called, but the bar connected to the wheels that drives round and round.
Yeah.
And then imagine if you put that entire thing on two sets of roller skates.
The entire thing.
The entire thing.
Holy
on
moly.
Two sets of roller skates.
That's like... the train wheels on top of wheels on top of wheels.
Correct. And then you told the people that you were designing it for, by putting wheels on top of wheels on top of wheels will make the train go faster.
No.
Oh, no. No, 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 no. This is this theory about...
this is real.
This is real.
This is the thing about the edge of the wheel moving faster than the middle of the wheel.
Yeah.
Right.
It was built between 1887 and 1897. The gentleman did it.
They were the predecessors of the Gillette razor blades. We've got, this one's got two wheels, this one's got four wheels, this one's got eight wheels, more wheels, wheels for days.
So it was set up in 1887, the Holman Locomotive Company in 1887 in Philadelphia. And obviously it was ridiculed by anyone with any knowledge of mechanics. And it was built and it was run on a few trips on a straight railroad in New Jersey. But here's the thing. It wasn't there to be a huge leap forward in rail line technology. Uh-huh. It was a scam. They knew it wouldn't work. They knew it wouldn't go faster. But it seemed really futuristic and exciting. And so they sold fake shares of stock in their company at $25 a share in an attempt to raise $10 million.
But no one asked to see the thing run.
But it did.
Yeah, but it just didn't go faster.
They did sort of the trial runs up and down this track in New Jersey, and that was good enough.
Right.
A chap called Angus Sinclair was talking about it in 1907. He said, when we first heard of the Holman locomotive, we supposed that it was the invention of some harmless crank who did not understand the elementary principles of mechanics. But we now believe that it has been, since its inception, an ostentatious machine designed to allure unwary capitalists into an investment which will be of the same real value as throwing gold coin over Niagara Falls.
As far, if you make a wish big enough.
Yeah. And as far as I can see, it worked.
They weren't prosecuted or brought to justice?
Nope, not at all.
They just made some money.
They made some money and then scrapped it. And then...
hid back in the shadows when they came. Whoa.
I wish I could find more about it, but all I could find out is that here's a picture of the real train that I found, because I showed them the design earlier.
Oh wow.
But there it is. Basically it's the Spinal Tap equivalent of train design. This train goes one faster.
Yeah. Crank it up to 11. Vicky's gone with handwritten notes.
I've got
and big
some
old
notes because people who love trains will know the details,
indeed.
And I don't want to get it wrong.
More so than any other nerd group we might have met on this podcast.
So I want to mention Brunel's Atmospheric Railway.
Yes.
Oh, yes, please.
Which you might know about. The idea was, it wasn't original, actually. I think Ireland had the first atmospheric railway.
What is an atmospheric railway?
Good question.
It's got very nice music going on. They mist some scent into the place.
Put some fairy lights up.
Yeah. It's quite cool.
So the idea, with a regular steam train, as it was at the time, you have the engine, the whole bit of the front of the train is the engine, which is pulling a set of carriages along. So the thinking behind the atmospheric railway was sort of reducing that bulk and trying to make the speed and the efficiency of a train sort of better.
Okay.
So you didn't have the whole effort of, you know, firing up this huge engine and it pulling carriages along. Mm. So they wanted to try and figure out a way that they could basically just make it go faster and be more efficient.
And drive itself a little bit? The carriages drive themselves rather than an engine pulling it?
So yeah, so there is a sort of engine at the front, but it doesn't have all the gubbins and there's no firemen shoveling coal in and stuff. Instead, the front of the train has a piston that connects to a tube in the track. So you've got your tracks as they would have been. And then in between the tracks, you've got this tube, which is in a vacuum. And that vacuum's being created by stationary steam engines in buildings along the line.
Right.
There's a pumping house at Star Cross, which survives. You can go and see it with your eyes if you get out at Star Cross Station. Mm-hmm. And so engine houses like that would be dotted along the line. They'd have stationary steam engines in them, doing what a steam engine would do to create a vacuum in this tube.
So it's almost like the train would charge up as it passed these stations.
Exactly. So the piston would come out of this tube in the middle of the tracks, sort of breaking the seal of the vacuum, and I'm not a scientist, so, so feel free to correct any random terms that I've made up. But the so the vacuum would be ahead of the train, and then as the piston came up, the air would sort of break that vacuum, and the pressure of that happening would propel the
train forward.
Propel it along. And it sort of worked. So there was an atmospheric railway between Dublin and what was Kingstown, but is now Dunleary Station. And Brunel sort of saw this and he thought, oh, this looks great. Let's see if we can recreate this. He got permission to do that.
Always ask the bill payer's permission before building your atmospheric railways. Because
you might still be charged.
And if you're under 18, please ask for a parent's help.
And please never return to an atmospheric railway once it's been lit.
Yes.
And it was supposed to go from Exeter to all the way to Plymouth, but they, I think they only got as far as Newton Abbot. And it sort of worked quite well, but there were, the issue was with the with this tube that created the vacuum, the seal was, they used sort of leather and other mechanical parts, and it's very difficult to know what is folklore and what is actual reality. But some people say that they had problems with the rats nibbling away at the leather,
breaking the seal of the vacuum,
exactly. And then other people sort of say actually it was more the salty sort of coastal air was rusting and not allowing it to like be contained as a vacuum.
Yeah.
But essentially the technology of the time
didn't
quite make it consistently work, and then it just became too expensive to maintain. And so they said, do you know what, we'll just put regular trains back on.
It sort of feels a little bit like Brunel was prefiguring electric cars with charging points along the way, because often inventors we find in here, and clearly Brunel's one of the best, that their stuff seems hugely harebrained or alternatively a really good idea but with a massive fatal flaw in it. But that one you're like, oh, so close, Isambard.
really close.
This is the, because the vacuum is the way that Elon Musk wants his super fast Hyperloop train. Is it called Hyperloop?
Yeah, Hyperloop.
Yeah. That they're going to work by, you do it conducted by vacuum, basically.
That'd really annoy me if Elon Musk basically manages to look at Isambard King of Brunel's homework and just like put the red pen around and go, wrong, right, I've got it fixed now. But the thing is, some of the things he does are like absolutely incredible. Like the thing, one of the tunnels he made where he basically would sink the tunnel into the river with men in it, and then they would dig along to the next bit. And like, and obviously, lots of them died, but not all of them died. But for that to even think that that could possibly work with the technology at the time.
This is the tunnel under the Thames, the pedestrian tunnel. And I think when they finished that, they had a big banquet in the tunnel.
Did.
They had a big table laid out and all the workmen came in.
It didn't take a railway for a good few years.
When I did the tube walk, that's the first time I ever discovered that, because it was part of... I think it was either the DLR or Jubilee line route. It'll have been DLR. Mm. If anyone is either visiting London or lives in London, I cannot recommend enough going along to... There's more than one. There's one that goes to the Cutty Sark.
That's the good one.
And there's another one at Woolwich as well.
And
I actually recommend that one more, purely because there's something really eerie about going under the Thames in somewhere that was built 120, 140 years ago. And it looked... In some of the underground stations, they've got the architecture of Victorian times.
Yeah.
I find it very difficult to put into words, but weirdly, I expect to meet Jack the Ripper there more than I do in <anytime. laughs>
One of my favourite facts about Brunel is that he trained with a horologist. So that's why I think...
Horologies in horoscopes.
Clocks.
Oh,
wait, sorry.
Wow, that's Ben's astrology moment.
I equally could have said the wrong word. I could have said.
No, you definitely said the right word. Ben is hanging his head in shame.
It's
not the study of prostitutes either, Ben, just to clear that up.
That we know of. So I just think he must have been able to see or understand how like the tiniest little adjustment in something could really make a huge difference, where maybe other brilliant engineers or builders, whatever, were, you know, just as sort of good and talented. But I think maybe because he had that sort of training where he was like, well, let's just make this tiny adjustment. Yeah,
think of the micro scale rather than just in the macro.
Exactly, yeah. So, but this is what I think I want to pitch as my big one is pacer trains.
Oh, yes.
They still exist. You can experience the wonder of the pacer train.
So people who listen to the episode with Steve Gribben about the worst railway will remember that he might have mentioned these because they are the outdated trains they use on the Northern Railway line, which is what he suggested was the worst railway.
Northern have probably the majority of them. You can ride a pacer, you can catch one, maybe not now because what they're doing this year might be a more pleasant experience.
Yeah.
In Wales, in the Welsh Valleys, the closest pacer to London, just so you know where they are at all times, used to be Retford Station, so you could pick up a pacer there. But they are, thankfully, for many people, they are phasing them out, because the big reason is because they're not compliant with accessibility laws, because they are essentially buses.
Yes.
So they were 1980s solution to getting more rolling stock quickly and cheaply. So they're Leyland buses. So you've got your regular sort of train chassis, but then they've stuck a bus on top of it. And so they've got those sort of folding doors that you used to get on buses.
Oh, of course.
You probably still do on some buses. That would, you know, whack you in the side if you're standing in the wrong place. And a step up as you go in through the doors. So they're 1980s buses.
Yeah.
And the seats are laid out like buses. Probably is, but it feels like there is no suspension in them. Watching back some of the footage that we shot when we were on our big journey around the country, just this, you know, when you sort of look through a train, when you can look through a train, and I love doing that on the tube when you can see the bit of the train in front of you sort of veer off first as it goes around the corner. So where sort of carriages connect. In a pacer, the next carriage is literally jumping up and down and moving from side to side. It's noisy, it screeches. People are so vehement in their hatred of them. I can't tell you how many tweets I've ever received saying, I can't believe you like pacers, because I probably should say I took the stand during our journey.
That
I was going to like champion pacer train because everyone hates them so much.
So we've got a friend who runs a show called the Ugly Animal Preservation Society, which is animals that have to be super ugly on the verge of extinction. There's something kind of lovable about them. And who couldn't love a blobfish?
Yeah.
And they are the blobfish of the rolling stock world.
Yes.
There's the thing, I can't remember the last time I was on one. It'll have been in the past 3-4 years, but there's something about being in a single carriage pacer train, chugging away through Shropshire and thinking, I'm living in the future. Like, this is, you know, this is it. Shiny suits and space travel and food in pill form. This is where we are.
I noticed that they used to have the nickname Nodding Donkeys because of how they bobbed up and down all the time.
And Spam Tins as well.
Oh, a day after Terry Jones passed away. That feels very appropriate to hear that.
Yeah. They're a temporary solution, aren't they?
Exactly.
They're only meant to be 20 years in service max.
Exactly.
And you said they were first ones were introduced 40 years ago, basically.
They're still here. Yeah. And that's the other, you know, reason why I'm like, do you know what? Like, they've lasted. Like, they're not the most comfortable train in the world. The condensation, and again, it's just like a bus. You know, if you've got too many people on a bus, you know, the condensation's dripping down inside. They're not the most fragrant of places. But they've continued to connect people across the country for, you know, much longer than they were intended to.
Yeah.
And so I feel they're sort of, you know, the love of the underdog. In terms of them being, you know, a successful sort of passenger service, they're not that great.
Yeah,
it sort of feels like someone has taken the ambience of a council estate broken lift and turned it into rail travel.
You have nailed that, my friend.
With the rickety metal shutter thing you've got to open and close the whole lot.
Yeah.
Well, I'm delighted to welcome back pacer trains. A bit late, but that's unexpected.
Okay.
I looked a bit at the tube, and I looked at the first day of the tube running. There was a lot of talk about what would happen when it was built. They were, the first tube lines were built on the cotton cover method, mm-hmm. where they were basically sort of, you could see down into the onto the lines yeah. from the street above. That led to some people nicknaming the project The Drain, because they predicted people in the street would fall in. Or some people worried that the tube would pierce an opening into hell itself.
Who are these brilliant people?
I know, people who've been to Balham Underground Station, probably. Like, there were several delays to an opening. Mm-hmm. It was meant to be opened by May 62 and was put back and put back and put back, which to any of us who live near Crossrail, myself being one of those people, yeah. it seems a familiar echo. But eventually, 10th of January 1863, the Metropolitan Railway Company opened and ran for the first time. And first class carriages are lovely. Compartments and seats with arms to prevent overcrowding. Second class had leathered seats, mm-hmm. and there were gas lamps in all the carriages, including ones that burned brighter in the first class carriages so the people in there could read, because mm-hmm. presumably yes. the plebs back further in the train couldn't read. But there were crowds of people cramming into the stations. A lot of the stations actually stopped selling tickets by noon because the wait was over an hour for ticket holders. Each train was absolutely packed. People were ignoring the class designations, just sitting wherever they could. And obviously there was lots of steam and sulphurous fumes and the whole lot. But by the end of the day, over 38,000 people rode the tubes underground that very first day.
That's
bonkers. I read an article in The Independent where they talked to a Metropolitan Line tube driver, and she shared some stories from behind the scenes on the tube. You can never miss the last tube.
Go on.
So long as you're through the barriers at your tube station, they will radio down to the driver. If the last train has pulled into the platform, they will radio down and say there's someone on the way down. So long as you're already through the barriers, you can't miss that train. I mean, you don't need to sprint.
That's an incredible piece of information and a public service that we've just done on this podcast.
Yes, you're all welcome.
After 149 episodes, finally something useful.
Do you want to guess what the slowest tube line is?
I would say Bakerloo.
It is indeed. And you know what the fastest one is?
Victoria.
No, it's Central Line, apparently. Ooh. But Central Line is also worst for overcrowding.
Okay.
Victoria
Line,
which is
weird because it's big. Sorry, it's because it's got really big carriages.
Yeah, you would think. This Victoria Line and Central, as well as Jubilee and Northern, are quite special because they're clever tubes, they're intelligent tubes, they drive themselves.
Yeah.
Hmm. They don't really need a driver unless there's a problem. The driver who drives on the Metropolitan Line in this interview said, "I'd be really bored, personally, driving on those lines." The phrase, "mind the gap,"
mm-hmm.
comes from 1968, the very first time that that was recorded. The recording here in a lot of the stations is done by a guy called Peter Lodge, who had a recording company in Bayswater. Some lines use recordings by Manchester voice artist Emma Clark. And on the Piccadilly line, do you know who does the voice, Ben?
Zippy.
No, Radio 4 listeners might know.
Oh, is it the continuity guy?
No, it's Tim Bentinck, who's David Archer in the Radio 4 drama The Archers. A census carried out in September 27, 1940 found how many Londoners sleeping in tube stations that day? This is during the Battle of Britain, of course.
Oh,
during the
hundreds of thousands.
Oh, I was going to say 20,000.
177,500
people. Holy Christ.
Yeah. Do you know who was famously born in Highgate Station?
Oh, yes, I do. I do. He's American.
Yes.
He has a chat show.
Yes.
I can't think of his name. People shout a lot on it.
Oh, God, Jerry Springer.
Yay! Jerry Springer was born in Highgate Tube Station.
I mean, that sounds like a strapline you'd see across the bottom of his shirt. Yeah. My baby was born in Highgate Station.
And
you have to pay for travel.
Yeah. You said a baby would be born inside Zone 2 and he's been born on the Zone 2-3 border. I'm leaving you.
And do you want to guess, yearly, how many times around the world the London Underground trains travel?
20,000.
Not quite that bit.
10,000.
1,735 times around the world, or 90 trips to the moon and back every year. That's a long way.
Yeah.
And you know what?
And you walked.
Well, I'm just thinking how miffed Aldrin and Armstrong must be to learn that the tube goes to the moon. That just saved them a lot of trouble. Do you know how you cross Panama before the canal? By train, of course. There was a Panama Railway completed in 1855, linking the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. 50-mile railroad, which basically, when the canal opened in 1914, follows nearly the exact same route across the isthmus. Particularly, it became popular with tens of thousands of people seeking riches from the California Gold Rush. They'd go down to Panama and cross over, and then go up the railway line the west coast, rather than doing cross-country across the whole of America. I read about a couple of American presidents on trains. James Garfield was shot by Charles Guiteau.
Yes, because he wouldn't share his lasagna.
Take his bag off the seat.
Yeah. He was shot in a train station, Garfield was. Yeah, yeah.
Can I just ask, was Garfield shot on a Monday?
Yeah, I think probably. Hang on, let's see. Let's find out. July 2nd, 1881, this is.
Yeah. I'll be so happy.
It was a Saturday. I'm sorry. It's so disappointing.
The strength of narrative in this universe is not good enough.
Yeah, Garfield was shot in the back by Guiteau, and he didn't actually die until about 4 months later. It took him quite a while to die. He suffered horribly during the aftermath of the shooting before his death, basically because his so-called team of doctors were fucking idiots. There was all sorts of infighting between them. They didn't trust antiseptics, which were a European thing as far as they were concerned. They were poking at him with fingers, not using any sort of cleaning. Basically, modern historians and physicians believe that if they'd done nothing, Garfield would have survived rather than trying to help.
Oh, no.
So anyway, infection sort of hit him, and he was beginning to go downhill. They could see things were going badly. They were trying to drain abscesses. And so he wanted to go to Ohio and die in his own bed back home. He wanted to see the old folks again, he called it. The doctors united around one thing. A 500-mile journey over the Appalachian Mountains was not what a man with a bullet in his body needed. So Mrs. Garfield, his wife, had been ill with malaria quite recently. And she had begun to recover, and she'd taken a trip to Long Branch, a seaside town in New Jersey, where there were ocean breezes and they were meant to be therapeutic. And so she said, actually, that perhaps her husband should recover there. And so they decided they'd go to Long Branch, said only 250 miles away, no mountains, was only take a few hours on the train. If nothing else, it would make it a bit more comfortable because it would be a bit cooler. It was a very hot summer in Washington that year. And there was a guy called Charles Franklin who owned a luxurious cottage near the ocean, and he said he'd be happy to let the president stay at his residence, and the Pennsylvania Railroad was happy to provide the train. The president of the railroad company was like, no, have my car, we'll fit it out for you. They'd make it, fit to fit his family and the doctors and baggage and all sort of stuff. And they fashioned a rubber mattress bed by the Navy Corps of Engineers, filled it with water and suspended it from poles that could be supported by 6 men. And that way they could carry him down the White House stairs into a wagon, take him to the railroad station, suspend this thing over the platform, and then, drive the train onto it to get him inside the train. And because it wouldn't rest against a solid object, so it would stop it from jostling and be cushioned a bit on the journey. Their only hitch was that the train station nearest this cottage he was going to was a mile away. And so how we were going to get him from there? They'd need another lift from the train onto a horse wagon. They'd need to go very slowly down an unpaved road. Another lift to get him off the wagon into the house. And so the railroad personnel decided that what they were going to do was they were going to build a new spur of track right down to the cottage, specially for President Garfield. The entire town showed up.
What, for the building of the
Each brought a bit of
They contributed a girder each. They had temporary right-of-way paperwork, had to be signed. They had to level the road. Carts of rubble were brought in before any track could be laid. And they weren't ready to begin until really late in the afternoon, because obviously it was very hot. They went right through the night. The residents set up refreshment tables. A hotel sent sandwiches out. And volunteers were pouring lemonade for all the workmen. And people with horses and carts just showed up and volunteered to carry away rubble. Boys who were too young to work were made to hold torches so they could work through the night in 15 or 20 minute shifts. And it worked. Garfield's train managed to pull all the way up to the Franklin cottage. There was a slight incline at the very end, and the train couldn't make it up to the So a dozen men volunteered and physically pushed the train the last few yards to the door, and the president died a couple of weeks later with his funeral train retracing that last mile, and then the spur of track was torn up again.
They didn't keep it.
Similarly, when Lincoln died, his body was brought on a funeral train on a tour of the country. They had 9 cars in the train, 300 guests travelling along with Lincoln's casket, and the casket of his son, Willie, who died 3 years earlier. His wife had decided she wanted them both to be buried in the family plot back in Illinois.
So what,
Willie
was...
Where did he hang out for 3 years?
I was going to say, was he exhumed? And then...
Yeah, seems like it. The train was called the Lincoln Special. It had these two corpses on it. In fact, apparently, the need to keep Lincoln's body preserved on a 13-day journey, where they would take it off the train, display it in various like civic buildings and cities on the journey, and then put it back on. They popularised funeral embalming, apparently, because they needed to keep this corpse ready to
looking
show.
A bit, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm starting to see how that film, Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter,
yes,
may have had a bit of its inspiration. He wasn't a vampire hunter, he was a fucking zombie.
Yeah. Well, apparently 1.5 million Americans viewed his body, 7 million saw the train and hearse pass by. And then he was buried back in Illinois, as I say.
I really hope that train, that the steam pipe on the locomotive looked like a stovepipe.
Yes.
Hat. How fast is it going? 80.
Yeah. This is the early days, of course, of the train, and seeing the funeral train introduced train travel to a lot of Americans, and played a bit of a role in the rise of luxury trains, because a man called George Pullman, who was an engineer, an industrialist in Chicago, he was interested in developing a sleeper car.
I suggest that someone with the surname George Pullman is, again, lovely nominative determination.
It really is. He developed a couple of models of sleeper cars, the Pioneer and the Springfield. Springfield being named after Lincoln's hometown. It was also known as the Pullman Sleeper or the Palace Car. It had polished black walnut interiors, chandeliers, and marble washstands. And they were very, very comfortable, but of course highly expensive.
Mm-hmm.
Very few people were able to afford it, and railway companies didn't feel like they were bothering to lease them because they had such a small pool of customers. But after Lincoln's death, the government decided to put the Pioneer into service and use it as part of the funeral train, because they had this entourage travelling with the body. And so, basically, getting free publicity on this tour of the country, it became a huge success, and they officially incorporated the company 2 years later, and led to... Basically, the company lasted 100 years providing beautiful...
Still going.
Yeah,
you
the
can
Pullman,
see
yeah.
Pullman's at Victoria Station sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. Yeah. And, so the death of Lincoln wasn't all bad. but my suggestion of the world's worst train is, we touched on this when we had Steve on. We talked about the Rainhill Trials.
Oh,
which
yes.
was the trials for the early steam locomotive. Who would get the contract, basically, to be one of the first public railroads, won by Stevenson's Rocket.
Mm-hmm.
And the Rainhill Trials took place in October 1829. And I'm more interested in one of the other entrants in the competition. Most of the competitors were basically steam-powered in various forms, but my favourite is the Cycloped. Do you know what the Cycloped is, Vicky?
The name is a little bit of a giveaway.
Yeah.
Is it powered by human legs?
Even better.
Can I just say that you made that sound as creepy as it was possible? I could make a train powered by human legs.
Oh, you're not imagining her chopping legs off and chucking them into a furnace. I was imagining a Flintstone-style situation.
I'm imagining her dressed like the Fat Controller in that Thomas the Tank Engine paper I showed you earlier.
Holding up legs.
Yeah. No, the Cycloped was built by Thomas Shaw Brandreth of Liverpool and was powered by horse.
Oh.
Not pulling it.
Yeah.
Not pulling it.
Oh, what?
Inside it.
What? Like in a giant horse hamster wheel?
It was on a treadmill that was kept moving by the horse mounted on top of it. Inside, and I am delighted to be able to show you both
the
blueprint.
Is this where horsepower comes? No, I know it doesn't, but like horsepower.
No, it can't be.
Here is the blueprint.
Whoa. Oh, the poor horse. Just one horse.
It's one horse, of course.
I'm a little angry that there's not a jockey on there.
Yeah. There was some controversy, not about the horse being inside the train.
About the cruelty to the animals.
No, about the fact that Brandreth was one of the directors of the railway for which they were competing for the rights to be the train running on it. But of course, it wasn't able to equal the speed achieved by the steam-powered ones, and the Cycloped lost the competition. The Rocket won the trials, maintaining an average speed of 13.8 miles per hour. Yeah, so the horse was on a drive belt, and its top speed was 5 miles an hour compared to the 13.8 of Rocket. Some suggest it's not even a serious attempt because it wasn't steam powered. It probably didn't really meet the criteria they were looking for in the first place.
But the director's like, yeah, I could do this.
Yeah. And as Steve pointed out, one of the steam locomotives dropped out because it exploded. Cycleped was the first one to drop out of the competition
because one of the horses exploded.
Apparently because the horse fell through the floor of the engine.
That trapdoor that was in there.
Yes. So our candidates this week for the world's worst train are Ben's suggestion of the Holman train, wheels within wheels within wheels. Vicky's suggestion of the clapped out pacer trains who have now lived twice as long as they were intended to. Are my suggestion of the horse-powered cycloped.
I mean, it's no contest, right?
Exactly.
The name alone wins it.
I am delighted to announce that 200 years nearly after the Rainhill Trials, the cycloped has finally won a competition. Before we go, I got to give you some of the world's worst news of the week, and this news comes from the Metro newspaper in the UK, where a man has been shocked to find his own grave at a cemetery. A guy called Alan Hattle. He said he was worried that no one had phoned him in 3 or 4 months and he couldn't figure out why. And he believes that people think he was dead. And he blames his ex-wife for putting a gravestone in the graveyard, though he admits he can't be certain. He's a retired welder from Forfar. He's 75. He also says, I didn't even want to be buried. I planned to be cremated. In the news article, he declares, I'm still alive, while standing beside his gravestone, and says reports of his death have been greatly exaggerated. The headstone was erected at a Newmont Hill Cemetery in Forfar. He spoke to Angus Council officials and wants to put a cover over the headstone. That's so Scottish. He's not going to get it knocked down. He's going to save it up for when it's necessary. Very thrifty. He spent 37 years as a welder before retiring. He said his ex-wife had bought the plot of land and put up the headstone with the intention of them being buried together. Apparently both their names are on the headstone. He said, I've never ever wanted to be buried alongside my ex-wife. We've been separated for 26 years and there's no animosity, but I'm struggling to take it all in. To find out you have a gravestone in a cemetery when you're still alive isn't something that happens every day.
He seems to have taken it in reasonably good grace.
A family member at Mrs. Hattle's home said, this is a family matter being dealt with privately. Quoted in the Metro newspaper.
Yeah.
So he said people hadn't called him for a while.
Yeah.
And then he was like, why is no one calling? Did he not try and call them?
You'd imagine.
Yeah.
You'd imagine he might have.
Maybe a bit of a curmudgeon.
Yeah. He's a dead ringer. Vicky, before we go, where can people find out more about you and your work and your videos and all of that?
Yeah. So you can watch our epic adventures on railways on YouTube. Just look for All the Stations and All the Stations on Twitter and Facebook and all of the social medias. If you want to follow me, you can follow me on Twitter at Vicky Explores. It's Vicky with an I.
Yeah.
Or I have another very confusing. Norwegian Cheese is also my other Twitter.
Norwegian Cheese,
which was like a fun thing, and then I was trying to be more professional, but I've got more followers on Norwegian Cheese than my
served on a Beatles made board.
Yeah.
Excellent. Well, we're all off to try out my new Van de Veldopede, where we stick Ben on a treadmill and see how far we get along the Northern Line. Thank you for listening to Words from Forward. Goodbye.
Bye.
First Foot Forward is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of Worst Foot Forward and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter via @podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.